This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in October of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. When NASA sent astronauts to the moon in the 60s and 70s, the agency excluded women from the Corps, arguing that only military test pilots, a group that then made up of exclusively of men, had the right stuff. It was an era in which women were steered away from jobs in science and deemed unqualified for spaceflight. Eventually, though, NASA recognized its blunder and opened the application process to a wider array of hopefuls, regardless of race or gender. From a candidate pool of 8,000, six elite women were selected in 1978. Sally Ride, Judy Resnick, Anna Fisher, Kathy Sullivan, Shannon Lucid, and Rhea Seddon. In her new book, The Six, journalist Lauren Grush shows these brilliant and courageous women enduring claustrophobic, sometimes deeply sexist media attention, undergoing rigorous survival training, and preparing for years to take multimillion-dollar payloads into orbit. Lauren Grush is a reporter for Bloomberg News, specializing in all things space. Previously, she was a senior space science reporter for the technology news website The Verge and hosted the online show Spacecraft. She grew up surrounded by astronauts and space shuttles. She's the daughter of two NASA engineers. You can find her at laurengrush.com. Lauren Grush, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's a fascinating book and important history, of course. What was out there before? I guess some of these women had written autobiographies, the head biographies of them. What was your goal in putting them all together as the six?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you know, there's plenty of great coverage and histories out about them from their own words as well. Ray has an autobiography, Kathy Sullivan as well. There's a fantastic biography of Sally Ride by Lynn Scherr, who is an ABC anchor, reporter. And also great books from other astronauts. Mike Mullane has a great book from the same astronaut class. But I just had noticed there hadn't been a biography that looked at the six of them as a group. And I really thought they were an interesting group of women just because they all came on board at the same time, and they all easily could have been one of the first American women to fly. You know, it was not preordained that Sally was going to get the nod. It really could have easily been any one of them. And so I loved that idea. You know, they all came on with the same playing field. And then, you know, what happened in order for the history books to be written and the marching order to be set. So I thought that was a really fascinating thing to uncover.
Let me back up a little bit. You were raised in Houston, right? Two NASA engineers, your parents. So you're surrounded by space shuttles, rocket scientists, et cetera. Inevitable that you would be interested in space?
Yeah, no, I've said this a lot. Yes, grew up with space in my blood, whether I liked it or not. You know, I owe my life to the space program. That's where my parents met. So if they hadn't gotten jobs at JSC, I would not be alive. But yes, growing up, it was very, you know, ubiquitous space travel and the space program. In fact, it wasn't unique to have parents like mine in the place that I grew up because we were so close to the Space Center. So a lot of people's parents worked for the space program. So I didn't really find it very special or unique. And in fact, you know, as a teenager, I found myself kind of cringing about what my parents did just because, you know, it's not always cool what your parents are up to. And so I actually found myself gravitating away from space as I embarked on my own career. And, you know, I was very creative and loved storytelling. But it was when I left Houston that I started to get a newfound appreciation for it, because I would tell people about my childhood and how I grew up, and, you know, they would get this look of fascination in their eyes. And so that kind of gave me a new perspective on it. And then when I started to become a journalist and become a reporter and could pick the stories that I covered, I found myself wanting to talk about space and innovation and technology. And so that's ultimately what brought me kind of in this full circle moment, you know, was I had to leave in order to gain that new appreciation for it. And now it's, you know, it's my whole life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a good life, yeah. So I mentioned your online show, Spacecraft. So apparently you explore what it takes to train for space. Maybe talk a little bit about that, because that gets us into what the six What it, I guess the training would be somewhat similar, or maybe it's different from today.
Yeah, well, I would have to say, you know, I had more fun with my show. It was really only a taste of what the astronauts had to go through, but it definitely gave me a better appreciation for just the rigorousness of having to go to space, all of the things you have to account for. You know, our bodies are just not made to be in microgravity. We grew up on Earth. We evolved on Earth where we are in a gravity environment. And so taking our bodies out of that and putting them into a space environment is just, you know, there's so much that needs to be accounted for. And I definitely had a newfound appreciation for training by learning what the six had to go through. You know, they had a lot of work on the ground that they did to prepare for going into space. Probably the most fun or the most exciting was they had to train on NASA's T-38 jets, which allowed them to get flying experience. They didn't come in, some of them did have piloting experience, but not jet piloting experience. And so they had to fly in the back seat with a pilot in the front. But and they weren't allowed to take off and land, but I did hear from a few of their colleagues who told me they let them do that. And then it was also, you know, some other fun things. They got to fly on the so-called Vomit Comet, which is a plane that does parabolic arcs and simulates free fall or microgravity here on Earth. And that gave them a brief taste of what microgravity would be like. But a lot of that was just information. You know, they had to be in the classrooms a lot of the time, learning the ins and outs of the shuttle, every component, every subsystem, you know, having to kind of keep all that in their minds in case something went wrong while they were in orbit, because, you know, you can't call a handyman when you're in space. You're the handyman. You're the doctor. You know, if someone gets sick, you know, there you have to be, you know, the person of all trades in order to take care of it. So it was a lot of information that they had to learn and technical assignments that they had to undergo before they were able to fly.
So the original, the 60s and 70s, all men, obviously, and in fact, I think that's what NASA was looking for. In fact, the phrase is the right stuff, right? That's kind of was seen at least as a very male kind of a macho thing. You've said that when they came to select these women, that there was no right stuff. They weren't looking for the right stuff.
Right, exactly. No, and that's why I love this group so much because it really goes to show that, you know, you can come from any walk of life and that you can have your own, you know, passion, and that still can lead you to space. So yes, when the military test pilots were selected back in the 60s, you know, they had made a very strict criteria that they had to have jet piloting experience. But when it came time to pick astronauts for the shuttle, they relaxed that requirement. They still prioritized looking for pilots because they needed pilots for the space shuttle. But because the space shuttle was larger and was designed for deploying satellites and had all of these various mission criteria, they opened up that resume and they said, okay, you don't have to necessarily have that piloting experience. And so if you look at the six, they're a great example of, you know, how this that relaxed criteria allowed more people to come on board. We have an astrophysicist, an electrical engineer, two medical doctors, a chemist, and an oceanographer and geologist. And so, like I said, it's very illustrative of the fact that, you know, you can follow your passion and it'll still lead you to space. It doesn't have to be one set path. There's many paths that'll lead you to orbit.
And I was surprised to learn that that one of Sally Ride was a tennis player, right? And in fact, that's one factor, competition, right? Cool under pressure.
Yeah.
What might have been one reason why they chose her to be first.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was hobbies and activities like that really played in the favor for these astronauts when they were first selected. So, as I mentioned, you know, these crews were going to be bigger on the space shuttle. People are going to be wearing lots of different hats. You know, they would be deploying satellites. They'd be operating experiments. They'd be doing all sorts of different things, not just one set task when they went to space. And so when it came time to select the astronauts, the selection committee very much valued people who could demonstrate that they had interest in a variety of activities. So, you know, they preferred having a degree or an advanced degree in a STEM field. But the fact that, you know, for instance, Sally Ride had that tennis experience, they really liked that because it showed it was she was multifaceted. And so it was things like that that really played in the astronauts' favor when they were interviewing and were ultimately selected for the program.
I want to ask you about the selection process. I guess started with 8,000, got it down to 6. But before that, what was the impetus here? Did NASA set out purposely to say, well, we need diversity and we need women in space?
Well, the purpose, first and foremost, was to select new astronauts for the space shuttle because it was a new paradigm shift that was happening within the space agency, going from these deep space missions to more routine orbital missions for deploying satellites and conducting experiments. So that was the impetus for it. But at the time that they were selecting these new astronauts, you know, the world was changing. We had the civil rights movement and the feminism movement. And so NASA was getting a lot of questions about why it hadn't included women and people of color in the space program, or at least in the astronaut program up until that point. And then internally, they were getting in questions as well. I detail the story of Ruth Bates Harris at NASA, who took a look at diversity and inclusion within the space agency in the mid-70s, and she came up with a pretty damning report about how women and people of color were employed at the time. And so it was becoming an issue that NASA just could not avoid. So it really was kind of this big moment where these worlds collided. You know, they needed new astronauts for the space shuttle program, and at the same time, they realized, you know, we need to fix this. We need to open up and actually look for people of color and women. And when they were doing the selection, they did make that a stated goal when they advertised it. They made sure that people knew that they were accepting women and people of color during the selection round. So it was definitely a priority, but it was also to find these new space shuttle astronauts.
Tell me about the selection process. You mentioned advertised. Was this, shuttle pilots needed? What was the criteria?
This was probably one of the most ambitious recruitment campaigns that NASA had done to that point. Before they kind of operated as a they'll come to us approach, you know, but this was a very big push to advertise universities to interest groups, and like I said, they advertised that they were bringing in women and people of color during this selection round. And they went to really great lengths to spread the word. They famously recruited Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek. She came to NASA and filmed a recruitment video in an astronaut jumpsuit, where she called on women and people of color to join the program. So they did a very aggressive advertising campaign for this selection, and it worked. As you mentioned, I think over 8,000 people applied, and they were able to find this group of 35 astronauts that included the first 6 women and the first people of color, the first 3 black astronauts, and the first Asian American to join the program.
Well, let's take a brief break. When we come back, I want to have you tell me briefly about each of these 6, and then we'll get into what they went through. For example, just a preview, we'll get into this in the next segment. The women and the first black astronauts were staying at NASA until late in the evening, I guess media, right? And then the other new astronauts, white men, got to go home early because nobody really wanted to talk to them. We'll get into that following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Lauren Grush. She's author of the new book, The Six. And we're talking about 6 women who were selected for the space shuttle program. Blaze the trail. Lauren Grush, tell me a little bit about each one of these 6, if you would, briefly.
Sure. So my go-to, I'll list them in order in terms of how they flew. So most people probably know Sally Ride, the first American woman to fly to space. She was an astrophysicist and tennis player, as we discussed. Following her was Judy Resnick, the second American woman to fly to space and the first Jewish American to fly. After her is Kathy Sullivan, the first American woman to perform a spacewalk. Anna Fisher came next. She was the first mother to fly to space. followed by Ray Seddon, and then Shannon Lucid, who was the last to fly, but would go on to fly more time in space than the rest of them combined. So just because she was the last, you know, she got the last laugh there.
I want to talk about the media attention, which was reading about this pretty spectacular in a bad way. For example, one of these women was asked if she cried in the simulator. John Glenn's not going to get that question, right? What were some of the other questions they were asked?
Oh, yeah. So it really started from day one. So even when they announced the first six women, during the first press conference, someone asked if, you know, Shannon Lucid's three children played a factor in her selection, because she was the only one to have children at the time when they made the selection. So just the fact that, you know, they were asking whether they were fit because they had children, you know, the men weren't getting that same kind of questioning. And it really was unrelenting. So when they first were introduced to the public or the press after they had been selected, you know, they got all of the attention. All of the astronauts were put up for interviews, and the only ones that wanted to be or the only people that the media wanted to talk to were the women and people of color who joined. And so, as you mentioned before the break, you know, it was, they had to stay late until the evening while the rest of the men, you know, didn't have anything really to do because the media didn't want to talk to them as much. And so they actually came up with a funny term for their group. It was 10 interesting people and 25 standard white guys, just because there was such a media focus upon them. And yeah, the questions were, you know, they were ridiculous at times. Sally Ride was asked if she ever dreamed of being born a boy, or, you know, Judy Resnick was also asked, you know, if anyone told her, or how she told people she was an astronaut. And the interviewers said, you know, what do people say? Do they say, you're too cute to be an astronaut, little lady? You know, just really things that we would, you know, scoff at today. So it just goes to show that was kind of, it was still a bit of a novelty at the time for this idea that women would go to space, and it was reflected in the questions that the media asked.
Do you think they felt extra pressure? They're trailblazing, they're kind of representing?
Oh, absolutely. They knew that the eyes of the world were upon them, and so they had to work extra hard to not mess up. In fact, before Sally Ride flew, she said that one of her biggest fears was that she'd somehow make a mistake or that she'd mess up. And I think that's a really loaded phrase, because she knew that she wasn't representing herself, but she was representing all of the women who had come after her, because, you know, if she made some kind of major malfunction in space, the headline wouldn't be, you know, Sally Ride messed up. It'd be the first woman messed up. And there's also a great moment in, you know, when Judy flew on her first flight, where she still realized the weight of her selection. You know, there was a mishap with her hair. I won't go into the details, but, you know, she basically swore her crew to secrecy. Obviously, that secrecy has since been broken. But, you know, she made sure that she didn't want that to be getting out, because she knew that it would be about her hair, and, you know, it might be damaging for the women who came after her.
So how did it come to pass that Sally Ride was selected to be the first?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting thing to learn for me. Ultimately, it came down to this one man, George Abbey, who was the director of flight operations for NASA's Johnson Space Center at the time. And, you know, he's often referred to as the astronaut maker. He was responsible for putting the crews together. And so it really came down to him. He would do it in consultation with others, but he had kind of the final say when it came to who would fly. And so it was time to put together a crew for this one mission, STS-7, which was going to rely a lot on the robotic arm, or robotic manipulator system. And at the time, you know, Sally was one of the best at the robotic arm, you know, manipulating that. And she had also been given a very cushy assignment where she was the CAPCOM, or the capsule communicator, for STS-2 and 3. So that meant she was learning how to relay communications to the crews in space, and she spent a lot of time in mission control getting that experience. And so really it came down to, you know, George thought that she was the best fit for this particular mission's parameters. Now, his selection wasn't universally loved at first. He did get a little bit of pushback from his boss, Chris Kraft, who was the director of JSC at the time. But ultimately, George convinced him through some very nerdy ways. I'll save a little bit for the book, but it was kind of surprising for me to learn that it really just, you know, came down to this, a couple guys making that decision. You know, in my mind, I thought there was some algorithm that, that they put these, you know, people's attributes into, and it spat out the perfect astronaut for the role, but you know, that's rarely the case.
You said that things didn't really hit Sally Ride until she came back. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so before she flew, leading up to her first flight, she really felt protected because whenever she would get an interview request or, you know, somebody wanted to talk to her, NASA would use the excuse of, oh, she's training. And she was training. She was very busy leading up to her flight. So she was kind of shielded from that attention as much as she could be before she flew. It was really when she came back that protection that she felt from training evaporated. And so, you know, the entire world wanted a piece of her. They wanted to talk to her. The interview requests just flooded in, and NASA really wanted her to agree to the interviews because they were very proud of this moment, this history-making moment. And so they would encourage her to try and say yes. But it really was quite an avalanche of requests and attention. And Sally Ride was an introvert at heart. So, you know, having all of these media interviews and requests really weighed on her. And at one point, you know, she sought out therapy just because it was getting to be too much. But, you know, ultimately she came around and realized just how special of a moment it was for history and for women and the women who looked up to her. So, you know, there was a time period where it really did weigh on her and it was very traumatic. But, you know, as time passed, she started to realize just how important and of a moment that her flight was for women, especially young women.
Did they, I imagine they were conscious of this, right? They're going to have an effect on young women coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Though I think mostly at the time they weren't thinking about their place in history so much. They really were just trying to do their job, you know, and, you know, remain focused and under this intense scrutiny that they were under. So I think that realization probably came after. But ultimately, you know, they were just trying to do the best jobs that they could at the time. And it was, you know, by being good at their jobs that they were these sources of inspiration for women who came after them.
Was there a competitive spirit here? Has anybody, any of these six owned up to the fact that they were, they wanted to be the first?
Absolutely. You know, these are all very competitive people, you know. Not just the women, but the entire class that came on board, you know, they were all used to being tops of their class, you know, the best of the best in their field. And so that you don't get there without being a competitive person. So they all were very competitive. And the way it's described to me, which makes the most sense, is that, you know, the sole aim of an astronaut is to go to space, right? And so when you see your colleagues go to space before you, I can only imagine that's a pretty excruciating experience. And so everybody wanted to fly first. Nobody really wanted to wait. And then, yes, a few of the women did express interest in being the first American woman to fly. But a few of them also witnessed what Sally went through when she came back from her flight and realized, you know what, maybe I'm okay with going second or third.
Of course, space flight is dangerous. That was brought in bold relief with Challenger, right? And one of these six was on Challenger. I think sometimes we forget that. I think probably maybe because Krista McAuliffe, first teacher in space, was on Challenger.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, a lot of the attention does go to Krista being on that flight. But, yes, Judy Rusnik was also one of the members of the Challenger crew who lost their lives. And I think when we think about Judy, we do think a lot about her inclusion in that. And obviously that's a big part of her life and her career. But I did enjoy getting to write about her first space flight, which I think does get overlooked sometimes. And it was a very interesting space flight. So, you know, while there is a large focus on Challenger in the book, I hope people do remember Judy for her time in space and enjoy getting to read about her first trip, because it was really interesting for me to learn and write about.
Tell me a little bit more about Shannon Lucid. This is she had quite a long career at some big firsts, including a long time in space, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Shannon was a fascinating person to write about. Shannon, I think, is really an interesting person in this book and a character in this book, just because she was slightly older than the rest of the women when she came on board. And that slight difference in their generations, you know, she experienced overwhelming sexism when she first came into the program. You know, she just wanted to have a job in chemistry when she graduated, and just the amount of pushback that she got and just trying to be employed, and not just being employed, but being paid the same as her male colleagues. You know, everyone told her that no one would hire her because she was a woman and she didn't deserve to be paid the same as her male colleagues. And so, you know, it really just goes to show in what these women were up against before they came into the space program. And then, yeah, well, you know, Shannon has a great first flight, and there's a great story in there about a trip she made to Saudi Arabia after the flight. And unfortunately, I didn't really get to dive deep into Shannon's amazing career, because, you know, she's really known for her long-term stay aboard the Mir space station. And, you know, thanks to that, she did hold the record for a really long time. I think it was woman with the longest flight time in space for a while, and I think the American with the longest flight time in space for some time. So she really did have a fantastic career. I only get to portray a small snapshot of it in the book, but hopefully people will be inspired to learn more about it, and you know, maybe there's a room for a sequel.
Yeah, probably each one could have their own book here. Maybe take the rest of them in turn to give us a little more. Anna Fisher, what was she especially known for?
Yeah, Anna Fisher was known for being the first mother in space. And, you know, she had a really fascinating flight. She was on this mission to go retrieve these, quote-unquote, dead satellites that were in orbit and bring them back to Earth for these insurance companies. And, you know, when she flew, there was definitely a lot of mixed opinions in terms of whether or not she was doing the right thing by flying. You know, she got some really nasty letters, a lot from other women who thought that she was, you know, being a bad mom for leaving her child when she flew. And then even when she was in space, she was asked, you know, how being an astronaut, you know, makes her a better mother, or, you know, conforms with a mother's duties. And, you know, she did her best to answer that question. But, you know, at the same time, she was surrounded by her male colleagues, many of whom had children themselves. They didn't get the same kind of questioning. So, you know, just goes to show the double standards she was working with. But, you know, what was great about Anna is she said that she had resolved that she was going to go into space. She was going to be an astronaut. And nothing was going to detract from her doing that. And so I thought that was a really great resolve. And she really showed that it doesn't matter if you're a mother or father, you can still go to space when you have children.
Tell me a little bit more about Kathy Sullivan.
Yes, Kathy Sullivan, she was an explorer from the start, loved maps, and also just she... a fascinating and amazing oceanographer and geologist. And when she first came to the space program, you know, she had her eye on the space suit. She got training with high altitude pressure suits and wanted to translate that into doing a spacewalk. And ultimately that worked. She was selected to perform the first spacewalk for a woman. Now, she was slated to be the first woman in general to perform that spacewalk, but the Soviets at the time were very keen on not letting Americans get the first on all these records, and so they sent one of their own women up into space to perform a spacewalk swiftly before Kathy flew, just to claim the title. But still, Kathy at the time said, did not matter if this was my first spacewalk or a thousandth or didn't matter if it, in the history books, if it was the first spacewalk or the first or a thousandth spacewalk, it was her first spacewalk, and that made it special to her, and she did a fantastic job at it.
Tell me a little bit more about Ray Seddon.
Yes, so Ray Seddon, also a surgeon, and she, like Anna, also had a small child at the same time that she was in the space program, and she was married to a fellow astronaut, Pete Gibson. So they had the first, quote-unquote, astro-tot, so the first child born to two astronauts. And when she flew, you know, her story is really interesting because she was supposed to fly in a different order. In fact, she was slated to be the first mother to fly into space at one point. But back in the days that the shuttle was flying, they definitely played musical chairs a lot with the shuttle order. And so at one point, her flight got bumped. And, you know, it was hard for her, but ultimately she did get to fly. And her flight was fascinating just because they had a satellite deploy that didn't perform as expected, and so they had to rework their entire mission to try and go save it. And I called it the heist, just because they had to, you know, they had to perform this unplanned spacewalk. They had to make these tools that out of binders, and you know, kind of doing craft experiments just to get the right tools to save this this ailing satellite. So I found her flight very fascinating.
You say some of these six didn't even know they wanted to be astronauts until they got involved in the selection process. And you've gone on to say that it's probably good news for those who are intimidated by others who have a quote-unquote calling.
Yeah, absolutely. I find that inspiring because I know for me, I know it sounds like I might have had a calling to be a space journalist just because of how I grew up, but I really didn't. I didn't know I wanted to be a journalist, and I did not know I wanted to write about space for a while. And so I always felt intimidated by peers who seemed to know exactly what they wanted to do when they grew up. So what I find really inspiring about the six is that, you know, many of them were the same way. They found their path, they found what they wanted to do, and then they just so happened to be in the right place at the right time when NASA opened up that selection process, and they realized, oh, I have the credentials, I feel like I would be good at this. And so I just love that, and it also goes to show that, you know, when you open up these selection processes, you really find people that you would never have found otherwise to turn out to be fantastic. So, you know, without this new push to find women and people of color, they would have never found Sally Ride, and then we wouldn't have had this, you know, fantastic historical astronaut in our space program. So just goes to show that's why these efforts to be more inclusive are great. It's because we find even more people who are fantastic and perfect for these initiatives.
Of course, the NASA program is, you know, pretty broad. A lot of people, not only the astronauts, but their, you know, ground control engineers, all of that sort of thing. Has there been progress made in terms of the other parts of NASA?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, even just within the space program, so or the astronaut corps, every astronaut selection after the six came on board has included women. Not all of them have been as large of a group as the first six, but they did open that door. And, you know, so it's getting closer and closer to parity as we move forward. And same with women behind the scenes. You know, it's definitely the ranks have continued to grow. There's still a bit of a ways to go in terms of the entirety of the space industry. You know, it's still very much a male-dominated field, but we're definitely making progress in that right direction. But even when it comes to going to space, you know, less than 1/6 of the people who've gone to space have been women, hopefully that number will be out of date soon. But for now, you know, there's still quite a ways to go to catch up. So it's still something that I think we need to be thinking about in terms of our recruitment campaigns and encouraging women to come into the space industry and the space program and making it really do feel like a safe and inclusive space for everyone.
Let's take another brief break. When we come back, I want to talk about, later in your book, you talk about the Challenger disaster and the role that some of these six played in that, including Sally Ride, who's on the commission. I want to talk about the latest initiative, sending people back to the moon, including a NASA wants to send a woman back to the moon. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Lauren Grush, a space reporter for Bloomberg, where she covers everything from NASA human space flight and the commercial space industry to distant stars and planets. You can find her at laurengrush.com. And the new book is The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. That's out and available. So, Lauren Grush, you treat in your book the Challenger disaster. Of course, Judy Resnick died on the Challenger, but Sally Ride was on the commission, right? Some of these women were involved in NASA's self-evaluation after Challenger.
Yeah, Sally had a very big role in the Challenger accident investigation as a member of the Rogers Commission. And one of the amazing things about her role is that she really served as a bit of a whistleblower for NASA in terms of, you know, making that connection that it was the O-rings and the temperature that was ultimately what brought the Challenger down. So, you know, I thought it was just kind of this amazing, beautiful moment. You know, here was the first American woman in space, you know, doing her part and making sure that the information got in the right hands in order to, you know, solve the mystery of what happened to the second American woman in space and the first teacher. So, you know, if it weren't for Sally, it might have taken them a little longer to make that connection.
I want to bring this up to date. I understand there are 16 active status women in NASA's astronaut corps today. Similarities and differences to the six?
Well, I would say, I unfortunately probably don't know them as well as I should, the active astronauts. I would say probably the similarities is they're just as accomplished and extremely qualified as the first six were. Maybe differences in that they have a long line of women mentors at the space agency who came ahead of them. I'd probably say that's the biggest contribution that the six made is that, you know, they really paved that way, and they had it maybe slightly harder than everyone else because they didn't have, you know, other women astronauts to turn to who had gone through that experience before them. They all kind of had to go through those uncharted waters themselves, but then those waters were charted, and so, you know, the women who came after, if they had an issue about being an astronaut that was specifically related to being a woman, they had other women they felt like they could talk to and turn to, and so they had it slightly easier. So hopefully, I'm hoping that the women in the astronaut corps, you know, have it slightly easier in terms of, you know, people that they can lean on, and also the press questions that they're asked. You know, unfortunately, I'd like to say that we're farther along, and I think we are. At least, you know, when it comes to the questions that I ask, I'm going to take these questions that the six were asked to heart, and, you know, make sure I don't stray into that category. But, you know, possible they're still dealing with those kinds of questions today. I really hope not. I think we've come a long way in terms of what we think the women need to talk about when we do these interviews.
So I believe NASA's goal is to land a woman on the moon. Is that they've stated that explicitly? Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. So NASA is currently working on its Artemis program, which is its goal to send humans back to the moon for the first time in, you know, more than half a century. And the stated goal of that program is to send the first woman and the first person of color to the moon. And that might be a controversial statement for some. I don't believe NASA's ever made, you know, who they're going to send a part of that program before. I think it's always just been, you know, the best person for the job. But I think it is interesting that they've made sending a person of color and a woman to the moon part of that mission, and I think ultimately it will guarantee their success, right? You know, if you they're holding themselves accountable, and by making that a stated goal, it just means that they will absolutely follow through. Otherwise, you know, there will be extreme criticism from those who are looking forward to seeing a woman and person of color walk on the moon. So I think it just goes to show that, you know, when you make that a stated goal, you, it will guarantee that you're successful.
Is Artemis on track? Is this going to happen, do we think?
Well, that's a great question. In terms of where NASA says it's going to be, they plan to land on the moon as early as 2025. I think most of us would probably think that is going to get delayed. It's a very complicated program, lots of moving parts. Specifically, it relies on new technologies, SpaceX's Starship rocket, which is being developed down in the south of Texas right now. You know, there's a lot of equipment that needs to be developed, new spacesuits, for instance. And all of that needs to come together in time for the first landing to happen. So 2025 right now is quite ambitious. I'm hoping for this decade. I think that if we can get to the moon this decade, that will be a pretty major accomplishment.
So presumably the first woman on the moon will be one of these 16. So kind of some similarities here that I don't know if we know anything about the selection process, but I'm imagining that that first woman on the moon will receive intense media scrutiny.
Absolutely. I think she's going to be the next Sally Ride, you know, and yes, it's still a bit of a mystery in terms of the selection process. I'm not sure quite how they're making those decisions. Maybe there's another George Abbey who's also kind of in charge of that process. But yes, she will be under the microscope. At least she will be very popular. And but hopefully because of Sally Ride and the six women, the first six women that I wrote about in the book, like I said, hopefully she will have it a little bit easier and won't be asked some of the terrible questions that the first women were asked.
Hmm. What is the legacy, do you think, of the six? What do you like to think of as the legacy?
I think when it comes to how I want people to think about them and how they view them, they really were just six women just trying to work and do their jobs in very extraordinary circumstances, you know. So imagine just trying to do your job, but having all the eyes of the world, you know, upon you. I can't imagine. It must have been such a pretty daunting process, but all they wanted to do was just, you know, fulfill this dream and to do their jobs and to do them well. And ultimately they did. And so, you know, it's a mundane story, but set in a very extraordinary backdrop. And I think that's what I'd like people to take away from it.
So just a couple minutes left. I wonder, just moving on from the book here, the book's called The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Woman Astronauts. Well worth the read. Just your general reporting, what are the big issues you're covering right now?
Sure. So as we mentioned, the Artemis program is very much a central part of space coverage at the moment, just because, you know, when NASA sets the tone, it's the space industry kind of follows suit. So with NASA's sights set on the moon right now, there are many startups and commercial companies that are trying to help in those efforts to get to the moon. So, you know, whether that be creating rockets, creating landers, building spacesuits, you know, building the various technologies that are going to be needed to go to the moon, there's plenty of efforts underway to utilize the lunar surface or create technologies that will be used in and around the moon. So that's definitely a big one. Also in terms of where a lot of companies are headed at the moment, these mega constellations, I'm sure you've heard of Starlink, SpaceX's Internet from Space initiative. There's quite a few efforts in place to launch these large constellations of satellites in order to connect everyone on the globe. And so that's definitely going to be a big issue moving forward, just in terms of how we operate these sustainably and make sure that, you know, it doesn't get too crowded in space. Also, there's objections about, you know, whether they're polluting the sky for astronomers. So, you know, there's a whole host of questions, and we're learning about the effects of these constellations in real time. So I think it's just going to be a big issue moving forward.
Is there another book you're working on?
Not at the moment, but as we mentioned, you know, there's plenty of great astronaut stories to be told. So maybe a sequel in the works. Who knows? At the moment, I'm focusing on my one job as a Bloomberg reporter, which does take up quite a bit of time. So I'll just have the one job at the moment, and then maybe in a few months I'll start thinking about the next project.
Yeah, well, unfair question to ask. So this book's just out, right? So
yes.
Everybody go read this.
It's barely a month old.
Yeah, exactly. The Sixth, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts is the book. The author is Lauren Grush. She's a space reporter for Bloomberg. You can find her at laurengrush.com. Lauren Grush, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. As we look up and over after sunset, grab the binoculars for a last look at Jupiter. It's just above the west-northwest horizon in moderately bright twilight, about 20 minutes after sunset. If you succeed, you will be among the last few people on Earth to see the giant planet and its moon so close to the end of its 23-24 appearance. And after dark, the moon is our tour guide for some difficult-to-spot planets this month. Luna has some especially close encounters with several stars as well. It teams up with Saturn and Mars in the dawn sky early in the month, along with Neptune, which is too faint to see with the naked eye alone. The moon comes close to Mercury as well, but it's a little tricky to spot. As the moon continues its tour, it gets especially close to Antares, the blinking bright orange heart of the Scorpion, near month's end in twinkly Scorpius. The summer triangle begins to climb into the evening sky now, along with Libra, the balance scales, and Leo, the lion, plunges headfirst into the southwestern horizon. Also sailing southwest on April 29, 1947, Contiki, a six-man expedition, set sail from Peru across the Pacific Ocean on a 101-day journey to the Polynesian Islands. Now, I don't know about you, but like the Polynesians, sailing takes me away to where I'm going. And we see clouds, altocumulus, cirrus, stratus cirrus, sometimes long streaks of white feathery streaks across the entire blue sky from the mountains to the west, to the mountains in the east, and sailing on the ocean we may see nacreous cloud. Nacreous clouds are a rare sight known for their iridescent colors, forms in very cold conditions at high altitudes. For nacreous clouds to form, the air must be colder than about minus 121 degrees Fahrenheit, or that's 85 degrees Celsius. Unlike most of the clouds which form in the first layer of the Earth's atmosphere, nacreous clouds form in the stratosphere, Earth's second atmospheric layer. Nacreous clouds are found during the winter in high latitude areas, including the Arctic, Scotland, Scandinavia, and Alaska. They sometimes form over other areas of northern Europe, but are most common in Antarctica. Some nacreous clouds are wave clouds, which often form near mountain ranges. In some places, nacreous clouds are so brilliantly colorful and unusual that they are sometimes confused with the beautiful aurora borealis or northern lights. Look at the Skywatcher Leo T. Facebook page for amazing photos of this unique iridescent cloud formation. And in spaceflight, Boeing's new commercial spacecraft Starliner postponed its first womaned and manned launch attempt. That was on May 6th in the nighttime due to a problem with an oxygen relief valve on the center stage of the Atlas V rocket. The crew flight test, it could take off as soon as Monday at 10:34 p.m. Eastern Time from Cape Canaveral. And speaking of spaceflight, it was on May 5th, 1961 that astronaut Alan B. Shepard launched for a 15-minute suborbital flight aboard Freedom 7 in a one-person Mercury capsule, NASA's first manned flight. And in a totally unrelated but relevant historical note of interest, in May of 1945, in the only fatal attack of its kind during World War II, a Japanese balloon bomb exploded on Gerhardt Mountain in Oregon, killing the wife of a minister and five children. Denmark and the Netherlands were liberated, as well as German surrender went into effect. It's one sky, many cultures, and since we've been discussing interesting clouds, in Australia and New Zealand and other cultures, constellations include dark clouds in the Milky Way. Aboriginal Australians give the name Dreamtime to the era when ancestral figures created our present world they call their tales dreaming stories, and believe that these stories give meaning to special places and creatures that are still with us. like the emu in the sky. Dreamtime stories like the one of the emu in the sky are among the most cherished. The Australian celestial emu stretches over a quarter of the southern sky from the head of the beast in the dark spot called the coal sack through the Southern Cross, then across the dense, dark region of the Milky Way to Scorpius, which outlines the body, and Sagittarius, where a bright star cloud represents the eggs it sits on. The seasonal movement of the emu in the sky animates the Dreamtime myth. Being close to the South Celestial Pole, the emu's head is visible from Australia every night. But the entirety of the big bird doesn't appear until April and May. That's when people say it runs across the sky, in concert with the mating season among emus when the females frantically chase the males. Make up your own constellations and stories and look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.